The Iranian foreign minister says the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal have a last chance to save the international accord. The U.S. Attorney General William Barr says that he has no plan to appoint a special counsel to investigate allegations of fraud in the presidential election. And the U.S. Congress passes a massive coronavirus aid package aimed at throwing a lifeline to the country's pandemic-battered economy. Thanks for joining us. The Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif has slammed the European signatories for breaching their commitments under the 2015 nuclear deal known as the JCPOA. Earlier, we discussed the matter in detail with our guests in the News Review program.
Welcome. Iran's foreign minister says the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have gravely breached their commitments under the accord. Mohammad Javad Zarif made the criticism in a tweet following a virtual meeting with foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Zarif said Britain, France and Germany should share the blame with the US for what he called irreparable harm to Iranians. He added that the trio have a last chance to save the pact, which he reiterated was not renegotiable. During the Monday meeting, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov demanded Washington return to the deal without any preconditions, a call also echoed by China's top diplomat.
The United States should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally as soon as possible. It should also lift the sanctions against Iran, third-party entities, as well as individuals. And on this basis, Iran should fully resume its nuclear commitments.
At the end of the meeting, all the remaining parties to the JCPOA issued a statement reiterating their deep regret over the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the deal. They also once again called for preserving the agreement. They said U.N. Security Council Resolution 2231 that endorsed the accord remains fully in force. Joining us is Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher, and we also have Daniel Lazar, author and journalist. Gentlemen, welcome. Keith, starting with you, so Tehran saying that the E3 and the EU essentially have gravely breached their obligations under the nuclear deal. What do you make of that statement?
Well, I think we have to look at it from the perspective of who is pulling their strings. We have to understand that the Western European states, the NATO member countries, are largely colonies of the United States. Now, that may be a somewhat hyperbolic statement, but only a slight one, because the European states are heavily dependent on the United States for their military defense. Also, in recent years, under the Trump administration, Washington has been squeezing the European states to contribute more to NATO as well. So we have to understand that the European states are under tremendous pressure from the United States to follow America's foreign policy line on every issue, including the relationship between the United States and Iran, even as the United States is actually pulling away from its European allies and strengthening its relationship with its allies in the Gulf states and in the Middle East and in North Africa. So we really can't understand anything that the Europeans are doing without first looking at what the Americans are doing. And the Trump administration has been very aggressive about first attempting to, abrogating the nuclear agreement that was put together under the Obama administration, and also escalating hostilities between the United States and Iran. The Soleimani assassination was one of the more prominent examples, but there have been many others. If we want to look at what's going on in Europe, we really have to look to America, because America pulls Europe's strings.
Daniel, Russia and China urging the United States to return to the deal with no conditions. Do you see that happening?
I really don't. I think that Biden is under intense pressure to attach conditions to the negotiations before he re-enters the JCPOA. Saudi Arabia and Israel are both pushing for that very strongly. So I think he'll do it. And I think, therefore, that will probably doom the negotiations because Iran will never go along with it.
And Daniel, do you understand perhaps Iran's stance here, that there's many in Iran that say it's America saying it's not the best deal, or Trump has described it as the worst deal in the world. There's many in Iran that also say it's not the best deal, in the sense that Iran conceded too much from its part as well.
Well, I mean, Iran has every reason to be absolutely outraged at the way this this whole thing has developed. I mean, the U.S. pulled out unilaterally. Iran was upholding its part of the deal. The U.S. pulled out unilaterally, slapped highly punitive economic sanctions on Iran, and the European countries, France, Germany, and the United Kingdom, absolutely did nothing to uphold their end of the bargain by continuing to trade with Iran. Instead, they allowed themselves to be deterred from trade by U.S. pressure, and the economic embargo on Iran was therefore all the more complete. This is totally outrageous. This treaty has been twisted around to Iran's disfavor, and I don't blame Iran at all for being furious over the outcome. Biden could make it up if he re-entered into the agreement without any preconditions, but I doubt he will do that because, as I said before, he's under intense pressure from the Saudis, the UAE, Qatar, etc., and the Israelis. All want him to step up pressure on Iran and to try to use the JCPOA as a lever to force Iran to conform with U.S. foreign policy dictates. And I just doubt Iran will do it because Iran knows that no matter what it does, the U.S. will increase its aggression, increase its pressure, nonstop.
Keith, do you see it that way as well? Do you think the deal is dead?
Well, I do think that Joe Biden may have some motivation to re-enter the deal because he was part of the Obama administration. And he would probably like to reclaim that aspect of the legacy of the Obama administration. It's something certainly that he could use to promote himself politically by saying he was the fellow who re-entered the deal with Iran following Trump's abrogation of it. So there is that element to it. And there are certain aspects of his party and his voter base and so forth that might be sympathetic to his position. But I do agree with what the other speaker was saying in the sense that Mr. Biden is under extreme pressure to not re-enter the deal, not only pressure from the Saudi lobby, then the Israeli lobby and other lobbies, Middle Eastern lobbies that are influential in American politics, but also because of the fact that Mr. Biden's victory was dependent in part on the support that he got from elements within the Republican Party that largely defected from the Trump campaign and colonized the Democratic Party, so the forcing the Democratic Party essentially to move right on certain issues, and a primary issue is U.S.-Iran relations. So I do see Mr. Biden being under pressure from that end as well, and that's going to likely undermine his ability to re-enter the deal.
Interesting stuff, gentlemen. Thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guests for their thoughts. Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher, and Daniel Lazar, author and journalist.
Welcome back. The outgoing U.S. Attorney General William Barr refuses to appoint a special counsel to investigate President-elect Joe Biden's son and the November 3rd presidential election.
Well, if I thought a special counsel at this stage was the right tool and was appropriate, I would name one, but I haven't. And to this point, I have not seen a reason to appoint a special counsel, and I have no plan to do so before I leave.
Barr added that he believes the investigation on Hunter Biden's tax affairs is being handled responsibly and professionally within the Justice Department. The president-elect's son disclosed earlier this month that the attorney's office in Delaware is looking into his tax affairs. Barr, who is set to leave office this week, also said that he would not appoint any special counsel to investigate President Donald Trump's voter fraud allegations. The Attorney General's successor has declined to say if he would appoint a special counsel to investigate the two issues. The U.S. Senator says dozens of email accounts at the Treasury Department have been hacked in a recent wide-ranging cyber attack on government agencies. Ron Wyden says hackers broke into systems used by the department's highest-ranking officials, what appears to be a significant operation. The Democrat says the breach seems to involve the theft of encryption keys from government servers. The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has accused Russia of carrying out the hack. That is while President Donald Trump has tried to minimize the impact of the attack. Contradicting Pompeo and other officials, Trump has pointed the finger at China. Both Russia and China have denied any involvement. U.S. Congress has approved the $900 billion coronavirus relief package after months of political wrangling. The Senate approved the bill hours after it was passed by the House of Representatives. President Donald Trump is expected to sign it into law. The package includes payments for millions of Americans. It also includes jobless programs and supports businesses battered by the pandemic. Democrats and Republicans were for months in a dispute over the package, mainly on how much money should be spent. The U.S. has the world's largest coronavirus outbreak. Its total confirmed cases are above 18 million, with over 319,000 deaths. The virus has surged in recent months, threatening a tentative economic recovery. Emeritus Professor of Economics at Mexico's Metropolitan Autonomous University says the new coronavirus aid package in the U.S. does not serve people there.
It's good that they made a deal, but the deal is a really terrible deal for most American people. It involves a tremendous decline in the amount of money that will be available for American workers as compared to the previous aid bill. And it involves a much smaller amount of money and a smaller safety net for the for the most vulnerable people in the United States. This is a bill that is meant to be a political victory for a very centrist group of people, and they had to pay a very, very large price to the corporate sector of the United States.
The European Medicines Agency says it is not overly concerned that the new COVID-19 strain currently circulating in England will be resistant to vaccines. The agency, which approves medicines in the EU, has just given the green light for the use of Pfizer-BioNTech jab. Jerome Hughes reports.
In each of the 27 EU nations, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine will start being used in less than a week's time, on the 27th of December. The European Medicines Agency has given its approval and has played down concerns that the new highly contagious COVID-19 variant spreading in England will not respond to the vaccine.
These are issues that need to be fully scientifically assessed. At the moment, we can say that there is no evidence to suggest that the vaccine will not work against the new variant of the coronavirus.
The UK is now isolated as countries around the world impose travel restrictions due to the new, more infectious strain of the coronavirus. There has been travel chaos for millions. People have been trying to get out of the UK before travel bans are enforced. There is major disruption at the main trading corridors between the UK and EU. Global markets have been in disarray due to the deepening health crisis in Europe. Rather than waiting for other countries to make the first move, epidemiologists are saying the British government should have done the responsible thing and blocked all non-essential travel from the UK. We have been getting reactions from members of the public in Brussels.
It's maybe a little bit too late to close borders, and I don't think closing borders doesn't help either.
We really have to stick to the situation, to respect it, and then we will, as soon as possible, be able to open everything again.
It's a new thing, we don't know what it is, but we need to act, I think, faster, and maybe in the beginning a little bit harder.
If government imposed like that strict lockdown like they did in South Korea or like North Korea and China, I think there will be riots here.
The European Medicines Agency says it is currently in contact with 46 vaccine developers and it expects to approve the Moderna jab on the 6th of January. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
India has reported its lowest daily number of coronavirus infections in nearly 6 months, with more than 19,500 new cases. The figure posted Tuesday brings India's total confirmed cases to more than 10 million. Daily infections have been falling steadily since a peak in September. India has the world's second highest case tally after the U.S. In Taiwan, the first local COVID transmission was reported on Tuesday. That ends 253 days of being virus-free. Meanwhile, South Korea has moved to shut down all ski resorts and winter tourist hotspots. That's part of restrictions to battle a third wave of the disease, mainly affecting the capital Seoul and its surrounding areas. Gatherings of more than four people will be banned. International alarm is growing over a new coronavirus strain detected in Britain, with dozens of nations imposing travel bans. More than 40 countries across the world have now blocked flights or travel links with the UK. That's an effort to halt the spread of the new COVID version, already causing panic in the UK. Meanwhile, Australia has become the first country to report cases of the new strain outside of Britain. Scientists say the variant is up to 70% more transmissible. However, there is no evidence it is more deadly. Experts say current vaccines should still be effective against it. The World Health Organization has said new strains are a normal part of the evolution of a pandemic.
The news was delivered Saturday that the southeast and east of England, including the capital London, were descending into Tier 4 COVID-19 restrictions. This was sparked by the discovery of a new variant of the virus that is up to 70% more transmittable.
Given the early evidence we have on this new variant of the virus, the potential risk it poses, it is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with Christmas as planned. In England, those living in Tier 4 areas should not mix with anyone outside their own household at Christmas, though support bubbles will remain in place for those at particular risk of loneliness or isolation.
After the announcement, chaos ensued as people scrambled to leave ahead of the midnight deadline. People bundled up presents and essentials and set out hoping to save their Christmas plans after England's chief medical officer, Chris Whitty, suggested they unpack.
I want to put some numbers out there because I think that helps to explain why I'm going to give the answer that I'm going to give. But my short answer would be, please unpack it at this stage.
Officials say that the ban on Tier 4 Christmas visits is unenforceable. And to make things worse, hundreds of flights were cancelled after the UK's closest allies cut transport with it due to fears about the new COVID-19 strain. The decision meant closing off the UK's most important artery with mainland Europe, a step British Transport Minister Grant Shapps said was surprising, especially as, according to him, the new strain is already in continental Europe.
We tend to be more aware of the variants faster. And there have been thousands of variants of coronavirus. It's just that the particular one that we've seen in Kent and London, the thing which has led to the Tier 4 lockdown, is a particularly virulent variant of the virus. So it means that it spreads more easily. We've detected that first, but we know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries.
The chaos hit just days before the United Kingdom was due to exit the EU's orbit with or without a trade deal. Brexit negotiators Michel Barnier and Lord Frost met in Brussels Sunday, but yet again, an agreement was not reached. In view of the situation, Brexit negotiations could be extended. Bianca Rahimi, London.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Do stay with us for a review of the top stories at the top of the hour. It's bye-bye for now.
Was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com www.cdc.gov/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam dear listeners, and we are with you with another episode of this series. This time we are going to discuss the method of Imam Khomeini's behavior with the students of seminaries, especially his system of payment of tuition to them. Stay tuned, please. According to a religious tradition, the students who study in seminaries receive tuition from the sources of emulation in order not to face financial problems. This tuition is paid on the basis of the level of education. This tuition is maintained by the money gathered from almsgiving, mainly in the form of khums and zakat and endowments. Thus, the government has no role in this. That's why the Shia clerical structure has been independent of the ruling system throughout history. Since the early years of the advent of Islam, righteous and pious people have endowed large swathes of properties, including real estates, gardens, farms, factories, shops, etc., to the seminaries so that they could use them for administration of those religious centers. These monies are spent for education, teaching, research, propagation, management, and relevant jobs. Of course, the money paid to the students is not sufficient for an ordinary livelihood. Therefore, the seminary students have to lead a very simple life and forget about many daily requirements, let alone luxurious life. Payment of tuition to the seminary students is based on Ayah 41 of Surah Anfal of the Noble Quran, part of which reads, "And know that whatever you gain, one-fifth of it is for God and for the messenger and for the near of kin and the orphans and the needy and the wayfarer." According to the jurisprudential terms, khums means one-fifth of a person's annual income that should be paid to the Imam of the age and the descendants of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, with special conditions. Of course, during the time of Imam Mahdi's occultation, this money should be paid to sources of emulation. Khums consists of two parts, the share of Imam Mahdi and the share of Sadat or descendants of the Prophet. Half of khums is spent for public usage such as research, teaching, propagation, and promotion of religious sciences, establishment of seminaries, mosques, and helping the poor, calamity-stricken people, and so on. The other half is spent for the poor among the descendants of the Prophet, since it is religiously forbidden or haram to pay them charity or sadaqah. Sources of emulation spend part of the tuition to propagate and promote the religion and another part for training of specialists in religious fields and securing a portion of the students' needs. Of course, this money is not paid to the students and ulema who work in a center affiliated to the government because they are paid by the government. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a great source of emulation who was very careful in spending tuition to the students of seminaries. In view of the Imam, being hardworking was a high criterion for payment of tuition. Thus, he used to give exams to volunteers and assign tuition for them as students. Late Ayatollah Muhammad Muhammadi Gilani said on this, after the Imam came to Holy Najaf and started teaching Makasib at Sheikh Ansari Mosque, he assigned tuition for students. Of course, this was done after giving exam by those who he had appointed. Those who could pass the exam would be accepted to receive the tuition. This examination program would cause the students to study diligently. Paying tuition to those who were qualified was of high importance to Imam Khomeini. Hujjatul Islam Mohsen Saghafi says, if Imam Khomeini realized that a student is interested in religious sciences, he would help him as much as he could, no matter if the student was in Qom or other cities, no matter if he knew him or not. If the Imam understood that the student was not able to make money due to studying, he would assist him in different ways or through his representatives or emulators who gave him money. Dear listeners, Imam Khomeini would react to those students who were not serious and hardworking in education. One of his reactions was to cut their tuition. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abdul Hamid Iravani recounts a memory in this regard. Imam Khomeini would choose different methods to encourage students and ulema to learn jurisprudence and attain high degrees. Sometimes, if someone was spending his time lackadaisically, the Imam didn't like to give him tuition. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini believed that paying enough tuition to assiduous students was a way of strengthening seminaries. Therefore, he increased their tuition notably. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Jafar Karimi says in this regard, one day, Imam Khomeini called me and said, the Ba'athist government intends to dissolve the Najaf seminary. Now I consider it as my religious duty to do my best not to let this happen. One of the ways to do this is to embark on the situation of the students and increase their tuition. Hujjatul Islam Kharaghani also said, when Imam Khomeini came to Najaf, the tuition of students was very unfavorable and most of them were in poverty because the maximum tuition that they received was 2.5 dinars. This was while the rent of a small house in Najaf was almost 2 dinars. As the Imam came, the first tuition that he assigned was 3 dinars. The next month, it increased to 6 dinars and later on it became 30 dinars. Dear friends, Imam Khomeini used to ask about the condition of students, and if he was informed of a poor student, it would surely help him. Hujjatul Islam Muhammad Ibrahim Ansari Anaraki says in this regard, the Imam was heedful of students, especially the young ones, and would inquire about their situation constantly. If they were needy, he would pay special attention to them. Although he was under pressure by the regime and Savak, the Shah regime wouldn't allow people's money to reach the Imam, yet he would do his best to help students. Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavitha Wei. It is called the biggest hack of the U.S. government in years. And the U.S., without proof, initially said that Russia is responsible. But now it has said China is also in on it. Well, the hacks were on such organizations like the Treasury and Commerce Departments and even nuclear agencies within the U.S. In this edition of the debate, we will look at whether the U.S. is weak and vulnerable against these types of hacks, or have the hackers actually advanced so much that it could risk world security. Let's find out first more about these hacks. Wyatt Reed is our correspondent who joins us from Washington, D.C. Wyatt, please tell us about the hacks in terms of which agencies have been affected, because, for example, you had the U.S. Treasury that came out and said, as far as we can tell, nothing severe has been actually incurred on their, I guess, operations. At the same time, one of the organizations, or should I say entities, that is not really highlighted that much is nuclear organizations within the U.S., if there's truth to that, to have been affected.
Well, you're right in that we really just simply do not know exactly who is affected. Really, we don't know the basic five W's that any sort of journalistic endeavor is supposed to encompass: the who, the what, the why, the where, the when. None of this information has really been published by any of the reports that have come out so far. Much of it is largely speculative, almost entirely sourced to quote-unquote unnamed intelligence officials, people familiar with the matter. This sort of language is the type that's being employed to source this story. So we simply do not know in great part, really, who exactly has been affected, nor do we know for sure who was behind it. All of the sources, again, on this are people coming from the Department of the Defense, from the CIA, from the NSA, organizations who would have an incentive. And indeed, we know that the CIA actually does possess the capability of spoofing its own attacks to make them seem as though they're coming from other countries, other organizations. It's likely they're not the only only organization with access to this kind of technology. So really, the most basic variables of this story are simply not known. I think that that will likely be the case going forward, but I would be happy to be proven wrong.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Wyatt Reed, our correspondent there, talking to us from Washington, D.C. Mike Billington is from the Executive Intelligence Review, who joins us from Hamilton, Virginia. Maybe he can shed some light on this and give us his analysis. Mike Billington, welcome. So our correspondent there has said that it's not quite clear yet the depth of the hack. Perhaps you can tell us about that and how this actually may have happened, because we're also looking at a duration of time from 10 months ago based on some reports that the hack began, and we're just hearing about it now.
I can't tell you the depth of it. I think your previous fellow was right that they really don't know the extent of this. But I think what's clear, what is known, is that we're seeing another case of what Donald Trump correctly says is Russia, 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 fake news. There's no evidence, none whatsoever has been presented, just as there has been no evidence presented over these last 4 years of the claims by the Obama and Bush intelligence circles and their British friends about the collusion between Russia and Trump, or Russia at all, not even with Trump, in the 2016 election. There's no evidence. There's no proof. The Russians have very clearly ridiculed it as typical jokes. And you may or may not know Bill Binney, who is a very close friend of our LaRusha organization and appears with us regularly on our programs, who was the head of the technical division at the NSA, who actually developed the Thin Thread program, which was designed to root out terrorist acts, but was then misused by the NSA to set up the most massive mass surveillance in the history of the human race. Still the case that the U.S., while it's screaming and yelling about China having a surveillance economy, has the most massive surveillance capacities in history. And as your previous spokesman said, what was called the marble framework part of the system that was set up and which Snowden revealed has the capacity to put fake source material in a leak in order to make it appear to come from Russia or Iran or China or anybody else. So this is known. I would say that probably the best proof that this is not Russia was that Adam Schiff, I hope you remember who Adam Schiff is. He's the member of the U.S. Intelligence Committee in the House who for the last 4 years has said, I have absolute proof that Russia interfered in the 2016 election and fixed it for Donald Trump. And of course, he had no such evidence any more than the U.S. had evidence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq when we decided to criminally and illegally destroy that country. This has now become common from this intelligence community. Trump actually took some major steps to try to rein this in, but he's only been partially successful. And we're now dealing with another Russia, Russia, Russia hoax, whose purpose is to set the stage for the Biden administration, if he gets in, which he may not, but he may, to be prepared for what they, in fact, were moving on during the Obama-Biden time, which was to prepare for war against Russia and China.
Okay. Let me bring in our guest, Vladimir Sotnikov, from Moscow. He's a strategic analyst from the Russian Academy of Sciences. Vladimir Sotnikov, welcome. So let me get first your
Good
reaction
evening.
Of how the U.S. Secretary of State was pretty sure, as he said, that Russia was behind it. Donald Trump said no in so many words and pointed the finger of blame at China. And our guest there has said that there is no proof that Russia was behind this. So first, your reaction to this.
My reaction, actually, this is a very good question. My reaction is it's absolutely rubbish. You know, Russia has nothing to do, and Russia just formally rejected these allegations and accusations of interfering by hackers hacking the U.S. Governmental, some U.S. governmental institutions and agencies. And this is absolutely rubbish, because nor Russia, neither China nor Russia has nothing to do with this. What actually could be possible that once some a certain non-state actor, and if you remember the ISIS activities back, two, three years ago, there were a lot of young, sophisticated, bright computer specialists, computer engineers from Western Europe, who came for big money to ISIS stronghold in Syria to work for ISIS, being paid huge money. And I'm not claiming that this is ISIS, but any possible non-state actor, any possible radical Islamist organization could be standing behind this and could making the hacking attack by these computer scientists who actually probably stayed with them and tried to penetrate the U.S. governmental agencies, CIA, FBI, some NGOs in the United States, something tanks. So this is probably like this. This is my first feeling, which actually I felt when I heard this news for the first time. And I think that the United States simply doesn't have any strong proof of any interference, neither Trump about China, nor Biden president-elect team, nor even State Secretary Pompeo, who actually claimed that Russia is accused by the United States of cyber attacks against U.S. Agencies.
Okay.
So that is my feeling.
Well, Mike Billington, to go along with what you have said, first of all, before we continue here, let me make sure that we, at least I know from you, Mike Billington, what your views are. I mean, do you believe that the U.S. was hacked, the different agencies that were involved?
Question. I think Mr. Sotokoff could very well be right that this is a non-state actor. We don't know because, of course, there's nothing being revealed about this. In fact, the person who was in charge for Homeland Security of our cybersecurity, this guy Chris Krebs, who lied and said there was the current election, the presidential election, was clean, there was no fraud, obvious lie, and Trump fired him. He's now running around ranting that this is Russia. And if in fact it were, then he certainly didn't do his job. But I think the other possibility, at least, that Mr. Sobukov would probably agree, is what your question implied, which is that this might not even be a serious breach. This might be an artificial breach run by the CIA. They have the capacity, as Mr. Binney exposed in his multiple studies of this, showing, for instance, that there was no hacking of the DNC computers, which was the basis of the entire Russiagate hoax, that in fact it was a download, that it's very possible that this is itself a hoax, a fraud, that the massive hacking may not even be true. In order to create a new Russiagate hoax to go along with the Chinagate hoax that's been perpetrated by Pompeo and the other radical lunatics in the Trump administration. But this is very possibly meant to set up a next administration if they succeed in getting Biden in, which they may or may not. There's still a very, very serious potential for overthrowing this fake election, the massive vote fraud that's already been exposed and never listened to in court. No court has heard the evidence. Every court has ruled that they don't have standing to protest this, which is why Trump himself brought the case to the Supreme Court yesterday. So this is all in the works, trying to prepare for Biden, who's already announced that he's hired plans to hire a Secretary of State whose only complaint about the Obama-Biden administration was that they didn't fully invade and destroy Syria the way they did Libya. And you can expect that will happen if you get the war party back in power, that the reason they had to get Trump out was because he's insisted on pulling out of these regime change wars, and they want to restore, in the midst of this massive global financial breakdown crisis taking place, only partially because of the pandemic.
Right.
It was already in the works. But in the midst of this, they cannot allow Trump to work with Putin, as he's insisted he should, and to end these endless wars. So okay. They therefore put absolutely everything they had into trying to bring down the Donald Trump personally.
Vladimir Sotnikov, the timing of this is something also that is somewhat interesting. And in terms of what the U.S. administration, if, as our guest said, the president-elect Biden gets elected to come into the White House, the chief of staff of the incoming White House chief of staff has said that President-elect Joe Biden's response to this will go beyond sanctions against Russia. So, if that is the case, what type of reactions may we see if and when Joe Biden comes into the White House against Russia?
Yeah. Well, actually, thinking about that in the retrospective, actually, that you remember that President-elect Joseph Biden actually promised in his election campaign that he will significantly try to get the relations between the U.S. and Russia better. So you are right. The timing is very interesting because in a month or so, there will be a solemn oath of President-elect Biden on the 20th of January, and the new administration came to life. So I think my analysis is that Biden is not going to significantly get the relations between the United States better, because for two simple reasons. First of all, some circles in the United States, right, influential circles, right, like the military-industrial complex, some hoax in the U.S. Senate, in the Congress, and some influential businessmen won't let Biden, who probably actually won the elections on their money and on their support, to move ahead with the improving the U.S.-Russia relations. And the second reason, a simple reason too, is that we actually evidencing right now, we are witnessing the new Cold War. And I agree with my American colleague that this Russiagate hoax, Chinagate hoax, or whoever gate hoax, they won't let the new administration to improve the relations with Russia. So that means that the election promises of Joseph Biden wouldn't be coming true.
Okay, Mike.
Unfortunately, this is my analysis. This is my forecast.
So, Mike Billington, let's go along with that line. What can we expect from Joe Biden, again, if he is successful in coming into the White House? What type of approach may he want to pursue with Russia, and what will happen if the aggressive stance against Russia, as it sounds like from Joe Biden's response so far to this hacking campaign, is that a window of how he will be treating Russia in the future?
You have to look at this from above, not from below. If you have a Biden administration, we're facing a global holocaust, and I mean a holocaust. The World Food Program has already warned that we could have 270 million deaths in Africa from starvation, not just from the COVID, but from starvation. We will watch the Biden team not only rejoin the Paris climate change hoax, but implement what they call green finance, the intentional cutting off of credit, and this is what's been organized by the Bank of England chief and his cohorts, a cutting off of credit to all, not only fossil fuels, but to any industry that has a so-called carbon footprint based on the lie that carbon has something to do with climate change. We're looking at a global holocaust that will make anything in history pale by significance. And the war danger is simply aggravated by this global pandemic, financial breakdown crisis, threatening war danger, and so forth. So you have to do everything in your power to help expose the stealing of this election by the war party that supported Biden and by the British, who, as I'm sure you know, the House of Lords wrote years ago that everything possible must be done to prevent Trump from having a second term and doing what he threatens, which is to be friends with Russia, which he said was a good thing. And same similarly with China, where he was working with Xi Jinping until he fell for this foolish idea that he should blame them for the pandemic. But other than that, we had the potential of breaking up this British division of the world between the East and the West and bringing the U.S. and Russia and China together in a way that could end terrorism. It could reestablish the Bretton Woods financial system.
Okay.
These are still possible, but it must be done soon. And by the way, I think the potential of Trump pardoning Assange and Snowden and bringing that truth forth to the American people and to the world is the best chance we have of breaking up to vote fraud and actually turning the situation around in the U.S., which is extremely dangerous without doing something like that kind of a flanking operation.
Well, we'll find that out in due time. Okay. It seems like that's the end of the debate. Let me thank our guests. We have Vladimir Sotnikov, who's a strategic analyst from the Russian Academy of Sciences.
Thank
you very much for your comments. And from the Executive Intelligence Review, Mike Billington, thank you for your comments. And that does it for this edition of the debate. For Mika Vatava, entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all. This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson, frauds and cheaters. Those who find their happiness in misfortunes of others and their profit in loss of others are neither humans nor true Muslims. They lack that social character which gives man superiority over other creatures. Losses can be inflicted openly or may be hidden through frauds and tricks and other forms of dishonesty. Islam forbids these. Remember, brothers and sisters, Islam is a lifestyle. It forbids these types of tricks and tactics, whatever the form may be, as is apparent from the disgust expressed in the saying of Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha, alayhi salam. The Imam says, one who defrauds or causes a loss to a Muslim or tricks him does not belong to us. Over here, and many other traditions which talk about, you know, they don't belong to us, over here it means that they are not from among the Muslims. They are not the part of the Muslim Ummah. So brothers and sisters, fraud and cheating and you know, playing all these tricks and tactics to deceive others, this is something that is condemned in Islam. Islam does not appreciate that sort of attitude and that sort of approach. Unfortunately, the world we live in, we see that those who do fraud and those who cheat others, they get to climb up the ladder in many cases. But rest assured, Islam is not endorsing any of those tactics and any of those strategies that are based on deception, lies, fraud, and cheat. Welcome back to your listeners. Today we are discussing the frauds and the cheaters. We don't like them. We all unanimously say we don't like to be cheated upon. Now, cheating and deception are despicable characteristics that are beneath a decent person. Intentionally distorting the truth in order to mislead others contradicts the values of honesty, which requires an attitude of sincerity, straightforwardness, and fairness that leaves no room for cheating. There's no room for lying. There's no room for trickery or deceit. There are many texts from the Quran and the Sunnah of the Holy Prophet and infallible Imams conveying the meaning that cheating, whether the target be Muslims or non-Muslims, is forbidden. Accepting the guidance of Islam leads a person to truthfulness, which means a person completely avoids cheating and backstabbing. A lot of times, especially when it comes to the Muslim youth, they tend to think that it's okay to deceive the non-Muslims just because they're not Muslims. When it comes to Muslims, they understand these concepts, but when it comes to non-Muslims, for some reason, they come to a conclusion that it's okay to deceive them, it's okay to trick them. Guess what, brothers and sisters? Islam does not allow you to be unfair with a non-Muslim either. Islam wants you to be careful in your attitude, whether it is towards a Muslim or it is towards a non-Muslim. Now, of course, there's a small little point that you need to keep in mind, and that is the non-Muslims who are at war with Islam and Muslims. Those are known as kuffar, kuffar-e-harbi, and those non-Muslims who are at war with Islam and Muslims, that is an exception to the case. Other than that, all non-Muslims are supposed to be treated with fairness. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.